This is Halloween. This is Halloween. It's yeah, also Friday. This is Friday Flicks. This is Friday Flicks.
This is Friday Flicks. Friday Flicks. Friday Flicks.
Time.
We're doing it. Nightmare
Hello.
Before Christmas.
Welcome to our second annual Halloween special. And yes, we are talking about the Nightmare Before Christmas today. But before we do, now's the time. I'm going to remind you all to hit that subscribe button, because you never want to miss our future Halloween specials. Who knows what we'll talk about next year. And while you're at it, write us a review. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friday Flicks Podcast. And you can send us an email at jkentertainment247@gmail.com to let us know what you think. Because what are we here doing,
email,
Jimmy?
Well, we're friends and family watching and talking. And if you write us an email, we'll read your email in the next podcast.
I would love to read some emails.
Send it over.
And ratings. But I can't do that if I don't get any. So please send them on over. Let's see who's here. As always, we have Jimmy Anthony, and he is going to be the wonderful Jack Skellington.
Cause I, Jack, the Pumpkin King, grow so tired of the same old thing.
I also wanted, yeah, thank you. I also wanted to do his laugh, which I kind of forgot, but it's something like, I love how he gets super like creepy crazy with this laugh near the end. Yep. Oh yeah. You gave me Jack.
I love it.
Give me Jack.
Nice. Thank you, Jimmy. We have Byron Anthony. He's going to be Dr. Finkelstein. Stein or Steen?
Stein. I don't know. Let's see. What is he like? Finkelstein.
You fed me deadly nightshade, Sally. You're mine, see? You're mine.
I love him so much.
Nice.
Sally.
Thank you, Byron. Cynthia Anthony is here, and she's going to be Shock, one of the trick-or-treaters.
Kidnapped the Santa Claus, beat it with a stick. Lock him up for 50 years. See what makes him tick.
Nice.
Lock him up for 50 years.
Grace, you want to follow that up with some lock?
No, Jack. We won't tell Oogie Boogie about this. We promise. Wouldn't dream of it.
Nice.
Nice.
Brian was supposed to round it out with Beryl, but he couldn't make it. But Daniel McCarley is here, and he's the two-faced mayor.
Oh, Jack, I've got the plans for next Halloween. I wanted to go over them with you so we can get started. Jack, I'm only an elected official. I can't make decisions by myself.
That was awesome.
Nice, Daniel.
Yeah, my God.
So good.
You've been pretty consistent.
I knew, like, last week that you were probably going to ask me to be the mayor. I just feel like that's...
It seemed right. I feel like I'm pretty good at assigning people. Although, sometimes things, you know, run out and I got to see what's left. And I'm your host, Kelly Anthony, and I will be Sally.
I sense there's something in the wind that feels like tragedy's at hand.
That's it. I'm not going to keep going.
Yeah.
I'll stop while I'm ahead, and I was on key. Enough.
Yeah, enough. It does get pretty high.
It's really high. All right. Well, we are here today to talk about the classic, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Daniel, go ahead and start us off with some box office and Oscar trivia.
Okay, so this is interesting because this is like, to go back to the box office of 1993, which is different than what I've been doing. So yeah, Nightmare Before Christmas was released October 15th, 1993. Made $50 million in the U.S., finished as only the 27th. Not like a huge box office hit at the time.
Yeah, I think it was...
Compared to the... Because it became, you know, its own industry like 10 years later. But yeah, only made $50 million. Interesting. 1993 is the last year, I think, that there wasn't an animated movie in... like the top 25, which is crazy. It's like going back to a totally different time. It was nominated for one Oscar. It was nominated for visual effects because animated feature didn't exist yet. I mean, this would have been a shoo-in because there was no other competition.
Right.
But yeah, that's what's going on. But yeah, 1993, this is the year you get Jurassic Park, Schindler's List.
Oh.
The Fugitive, Mrs. Doubtfire, Sleepless in Seattle. What else? Free Willy. You guys remember Free Willy? That was 93. Yeah.
Who doesn't remember Free Willy?
Cool Runnings. You guys remember Cool Runnings?
Oh, yeah. The Jamaican team. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Feel the rhythm.
Jamaica, we have a bobsled team.
Oh, man.
Come on.
Oh man, that would be a trip to rewatch that one. I haven't seen that one in a while, you guys.
It's on Disney Plus.
Hocus Pocus came out in 93.
Hocus Pocus, the same year.
Yeah, the same year.
They're like the two classic Halloween movies from Disney. They came out the same year. Crazy.
Yeah, and they both were considered flops.
Yes.
They both were considered flops.
Hocus Pocus,
now they're like classics. Yeah, more so for sure.
I think Hocus Pocus was really like considered a flop, and I think that like it was like TV runs that really turned Hocus Pocus into a classic. But
sort of like the way Christmas Story became a classic by being run on TV constantly.
They
gave a similar treatment to Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, but I always found it interesting that those two movies came out the same year.
Yeah,
I mean, this is like, you know, Are You Afraid of the Dark was also on TV. Goosebump books had started selling in the fall of 92 and were like becoming a trend. And it was interesting.
Yeah,
like
this year started that like spooky trend that we grew up with
something
in the 90s.
Like, yeah, children's horror was a huge thing in the 90s. And that really like explodes in 93. And it's like really fascinating that
that makes so much sense.
Those were the days. Y'all remember that?
They were,
Goosebumps.
Yeah, remember when like, I feel like we grew up at a time when like we weren't. Like, we were growing up with, like, you're not scared of things. And then I feel like this new generation is all about, like, oh, I don't want my kid to watch that. Although they can watch whatever they want with the internet now, I guess. But I don't know.
Yeah, they're all screwed. No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, they Disney released Hocus Pocus in July. Because back then, Halloween wasn't really, like, a season. Like, they released this movie in the middle of October, trying to get, like, the tail end of Halloween season. Whereas nowadays, they would have released this movie, like, probably at, like, the end of September to, like, get the full month of October box office in there. It's just interesting how, like, Halloween culture has changed even since the 90s. But, yeah, I honestly think Nightmare would have been more of a success if Disney... knew how to market this. They didn't know how to market this movie. It was originally going to be under the Disney umbrella, and it was going to be because there wasn't a Disney animated film that came out this year, because 92 was Aladdin and 94 was Beauty and the Beast, right? No, Lion King.
It was Lion King.
Yeah. And it was going to be this movie, but then when Disney saw how like creepy and weird it was, they changed it to Touchstone, and they gave it the PG rating, and
yeah,
it's just,
I mean, it's hard to imagine kindergartners or first graders watching this movie and enjoying it and not being like scared and having nightmares about it.
Really,
I mean, maybe some. Sorry.
It's funny though, because I feel like I watched this as a kid on videotape, and it was like certain parts were a little creepy, but it wasn't like scary at all. I don't know.
No, yeah. It didn't seem scary. Dude, I was in preschool and I remember like we went to see it, and this was like the first PG movie we ever saw, Kelly.
Oh.
Thing. When we were like 4 years
old. We went and saw this. I was...
And, like...
It took a preschool to the movies?
No. We went...
Like, it re- saying, did it like, re-release? Because this movie came out when I was 1 year old.
I don't know. But we definitely went to the theaters. And I remember they re-released it. It was controversial among the other parents at the preschool.
I mean, yeah.
Maybe it was the first movie you saw.
It's possible. If you had a little kid and a baby, the baby went to the movies.
Yeah. And I slept through it. Maybe this is why I love animation so much in Disney, you guys. My mom started me young.
Could be.
Takeaway, the 90s were a very different time. And were awesome because we were little kids, so we only see it through nostalgia glasses.
Yeah, nostalgic.
Makes it really awesome. So
hindsight, yeah.
I was just going to say, Tim Burton had just done Batman prior to this.
Well, I have some facts about... Sorry, I'm totally interrupting you, Byron.
No, please, go. I have
some facts about how he got the plot and stuff, if you want to hear those, but I don't know.
I would like to hear it.
But, okay, so he got the idea for the movie from a poem that he had written, and it only had three characters in it. I think it was Jack, the dog, and Santa Claus. And then, so he fleshed it out. He originally wanted it to be a TV series, but that didn't take, so he did a movie. And he said that the story came from growing up in Burbank, California. There's not a lot of seasonal changes. So the only way he could mark the year passing was through holiday decorations. And because there, the holiday decorations would sit on shelves for so long, the holidays would be intermingling. So Christmas would be with Easter, would be with Halloween. And that's how we got the idea for that, holiday world. He also was super inspired by Rankin and Bass, who did Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and all those classic claymation movies.
Ah. So
took a lot of inspiration from that style for this, which is pretty obvious. You can see that.
And the Grinch who stole Christmas is not claymation, but also clearly an inspiration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought of that too.
They had to have 400 some jackheads to film him with all his various emotions. Sorry if I took one of your fun facts.
The Sally puppet had just a face that came off and was interchangeable. So they had different masks.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah. But it's true. The way they make his eyes just different shapes, sort of the way you shape eyebrows to give different emotions, but mm-hmm. it's just like the holes.
And
it's
they really decided effective. To have his eyes blink. And that took three separate photos for every single eye blink.
Yeah, which is happening in the midst of so much other action mm-hmm. being animated too. Doors are closing, the camera's moving, he is gesturing, and his eyes are blinking. And they have to keep track of all those changes. Mm-hmm. Pretty crazy.
It's wild.
I think it's 24 frames per second of the film.
Yeah.
But why did they opt to do that when animation was becoming so much more technologically advanced and kind of the new trend? I mean, why did they do stop motion?
Where it was because it would not have looked anywhere as good as this looks.
Oh. Yeah.
And it just gives such a texture and otherworldly, so cool.
Well,
when
Tim Burton came up with this idea, he always wanted it to be stop motion because, like Gray said, he was inspired by Rankin and Bass, who did the Rudolph specials and everything in the 50s. So he always wanted it to be stop motion because of those things. He originally, I think Gray said TV series. I think it was just a TV special, a 45-minute thing, because those were TV specials. So this was actually this is the very first full-length feature claymation film ever done. And they've only done a few of them. There aren't that many because it's so tedious. It's so mm-hmm. much work. And there's there's just so few people who even have the skill of stop motion animation mm-hmm. in Hollywood. So few people. I saw something that said basically when they made this film, they pretty much got all the stop motion people in the business to work on it, which was only 15 people. There weren't even that many people even doing this, but go ahead, Grace.
I was just going to say that they also had really skilled cameramen doing everything, and they lit. So they made a quarter scale model up for the set, and they lit the set as if it was a real soundstage. So then they had to have like a bunch of skilled cameramen being able to move around these puppets perfectly and everything. And there were 8 different full camera crews. Apparently there are that many of them.
Yeah, they needed to have like 8 setups filming simultaneously because it took so long to film 1 minute, you know.
So they made like a little skeleton model that looks just like Jack, and then would have to bend one knee.
Yes.
And then film it. And then move forward. Bend the other knee, film it. Every single thing.
Yeah, so it took them a week to make 1 minute of film.
How big do you think the puppets were? You know, like
they were a quarter of their life size, apparently. Yeah, so they were like,
I wonder if they exist somewhere.
They do. You can see photos of them online and stuff.
Yeah, or if they're in a museum or something.
There's this series on Disney Plus called Prop Culture, where each episode this guy goes around trying to find like famous movie like film pieces, like set pieces and stuff. And there's one episode about The Nightmare Before Christmas where he tries to find like the original Jack Skellington puppet or something like that. It's a pretty interesting show. But yeah, I know that some of this stuff has been lost because he was trying to find it in that show. But I'm sure some people have bought it. Like, I'm sure the pieces are kind of everywhere. Because, like I said, this movie was sort of a flop. So when it was done wrapping, Disney wasn't like trying to, you know, back then if a movie was a flop, and still kind of, but I think more back then, if the movie was a flop, the studio would just like try to move on and pretend it didn't happen.
So they
this movie wasn't like a huge, huge flop, but still, they probably weren't super meticulous about keeping track of all the puppets and everything.
But the merchandising since that movie came out, right? So many
but
things.
So much later. It had like a resurgence, I think.
It didn't start until like 10 years later, like in the early 2000s.
Yeah, once the kids
around around the time I was in high school, around the time that it was, you know, name dropped in Blink 182 songs. And and like, you know, and like Hot Topic was like the whole thing.
Yeah.
That
when the alt culture started becoming pop culture, he was like a icon of the whole Hot Topic situation. Jack Skellington, a fucking bunny.
Yeah.
Mean bunny.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like around the time they made Corpse Bride, which seemed like to sort of capitalize on this trend, we're going to see if we can make more money with a similar thing.
Oh, it's Tim Burton too. Corpse. He just does the same thing. Always.
He apparently did turn down a CGI sequel.
Yeah.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, really. That would not have been ideal.
And kept it pure, so to speak.
Oh, also, Jack Skellington reappears in James and the Giant Peach in 1996. He's like a pirate captain in there briefly.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is right. I
do remember that scene.
So wasn't like Tim Burton an animator for Walt Disney Studios?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Before we keep going, let me do my very short synopsis and then kind of continue this going into more of the backstory of this film. Just in case anyone out there hasn't seen this movie, which I found hard to believe, but I'm sure there are people who have never seen it. Jack Skellington, the main character, is Pumpkin King of Halloween Land and is bored with doing the same thing every year for Halloween. One day he stumbles into Christmastown and is so taken by the idea of Christmas that he tries to get the resident bats, ghouls, and goblins of Halloween Land to help him put Christmas on instead of Halloween, but alas, they can't quite get it right. So like Gray said, this originated as an idea of Tim Burton's. He wrote it as a poem in the early 80s. He was working for Disney Animated Studios in the early 80s. He was actually the animator on Fox and the Hound. He was responsible for animating the female fox character, which I can't remember her name right now, which is kind of funny to think that he animated that fox. He was hired on like this 2-year Disney animator thing they would do, And after the 2 years, they let him go because he was just this like weirdo that wasn't really meshing with the Disney family friendly style. But because he brought up this idea for the Nightmare Before Christmas when he worked there, Disney owned the rights to the story. They didn't want to do it. He left the studios. Then he became like Hollywood's most popular director with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, and then Batman. And he decided, well, I want to make this movie now. And he went back to Disney and said, hey, will you sell me my story back? He was just going to buy it back from them. And because he was like Hollywood's biggest actor, Disney went, well, how about instead of us? Sorry, director. Thank you. I said actor. Instead of selling it back to you, why don't you make it with us? So that's where it started. He was good friends with Danny Elfman because Danny Elfman had done the music for those same three movies, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, and Batman. So he was like, okay, I would like to hire you to do the music and the songs. And of course he said yes. But because of the success of Batman, Warner Brothers also said, all right, let's do the Batman sequel and do whatever you want. Well, Disney also said, make this movie. You're the hottest director in Hollywood. It's fully your creative control. Do whatever you want. So he had to pick between Batman and Nightmare Before Christmas. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Tim Burton did not actually direct this film.
Oh.
Henry Selick did.
Yes.
So there is some controversy, you know, between whose movie is it really? It was Tim's, you know, baby and idea and vision, but Henry Selick is the one who actually made it happen.
Right. I think that has to be due in part to the stop motion and the complexities of shooting.
Well, that's why he hired, he was already friends with him, but Henry Selick was like the main guy doing stop motion. He was doing a lot of commercials and like the MTV little bits they would do and everything.
Right.
But
right.
He was like the stop motion guy and he made this happen. So, that's kind of where it went. But because Tim Burton was busy with Batman, he wasn't directing it. He also didn't actually really write the screenplay. They hired some other guy to write it who kind of fell through. And because it takes so long to make, like Gray said, they were like, we got to start making this movie. But there was no script. So they actually, Danny Elfman started writing the songs before there was even a script. All he had was the basic pieces of the story. So this movie started with all the songs and then they just pieced the songs together later with the rest of the script, which is why the songs are so good, I think, which is why the songs are so wordy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just really interesting.
It's like the characters' feelings and everything were being conveyed through lyrics that were being written before any dialogue. So
yeah. Apparently
makes a lot of sense.
Show him like some sketches and ideas. Tim Burton would tell Danny Elfman the vibes pretty much, and he would write him a song, and then they would just make that. The first thing they filmed was "What's This?" just because they knew that that sequence was going to happen.
I love that.
Yeah.
So those of you that are kind of sort of in the industry, I want to know how it is that a person's name gets top billing. Because this, as far as I know, this is known as Tim Burton's The Night Before Christmas.
It literally is called that.
So,
yeah.
Right. So was it when it was first presented, was it that way? Did they add Tim Burton's name later or no? They associated his name because he was such a star factor, right? Such
when
a
they realized, director. Yeah, exactly. You're totally right on.
You know, so the director that really did so much of the creative work and the screenwriters don't, it's just all Tim Burton, baby. You're right, Kelly.
Yeah, we all it was that. Some, there was definitely like some hard feelings between that, like, friends group after Disney decided to do that, because again, like I said, they didn't know how to market this because it was so weird. So they're like, if we flash Tim Burton's name on everything with the movie, more people will probably go.
Yeah, but Tim Burton and his agent probably pulled real hard for them to do that.
I was gonna say, Somebody worked that out big time. I mean, it's before Disney or anything. I didn't even know it was a Disney movie necessarily.
See that, and then it's Touchstone, right? So this is whole identity crisis of like, whose is this? And I think it kind of speaks to the nature of doing a spooky movie for kids. It's like Disney can't put their name on it necessarily.
They put it back since.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, no, of course. Yeah. Well, yeah.
It says Walt Disney Presents now at the beginning of the movie.
See that now everybody wants a little piece of the pie. Walt Disney Presents Tim Burton's poem that's adapted by this guy and directed by that guy. There you go.
Yeah.
Yep. But anyways, the music is such a big part of the movie. Jimmy, do you want to give a little bit more detail behind the history of the music? Since we're still in the making of sort of discussion.
Well, you pretty much covered most of it. Just that the movie originated as music. There was nothing before the music other than these like pieces of art that Tim Burton had created. So, yeah, you know, the music is kind of classic Danny Elfman, but it's also so Tim Burton. It's so creepy and sort of... what's the word I'm looking for? Not atonal, but dissonant, I guess.
Campy, like, too.
Campy, sure. But then it's got its different characteristics. And when you go to, you know, Christmastown, it's obviously got a very different sound. And that was obviously very intentional. And it's interesting to me to know that that was the first scene that they animated, because it is so very different than the rest. Oh, I wanted to add to that point that that was also the first scene they filmed because they knew they needed to show something to Disney of what they were working on. And it was the easiest one to, you know, be like,
are you saying it was the Christmas one? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. What's this? Mm-hmm. Which is an amazing number. Anyway, we'll talk about that more later. But yeah, so Danny Elfman had only done... I mean, he'd done several big movies before this as a composer. But prior to that, if you don't know, he was the front man for a band called Oingo Boingo in the 90s.
Ah,
who,
80s.
Yeah, had sorry, that's what I meant to say, in the 80s. He had several hits, Weird Science, and there's like one called Little Girls that I like. And anyway, I don't know that much about Oingo. Yeah, Daniel, what else?
And most appropriately, Dead Man's Party.
Oh, duh, of course. Most appropriately, indeed. But prior to getting to know Tim Burton somehow, I can't remember how they came to his... Oh, it was actually through Paul Reubens. So Tim Burton was given the job of directing Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Paul Reubens was a huge Oingo Boingo fan and was like, yo, we need to get this guy to do the music. And Danny Elfman was like, I can't do this. Like, no, you need to find someone else. And they were like, or he was telling his agent that, and his agent's like, well, then you tell them that you're not going to do this. And he was like, okay, fine, fuck it, I'll do it. Like, when it came down to it, he couldn't pass it up. So that, like, you know, altered the course of his life and all of ours.
Well, I want to be specific that when they called him, he thought they originally, he's like, oh, they want me to write some original songs, like singing songs for the movie. But they said, no, we want you to score it. And Danny Elfman's like, I don't score. I'm not a composer. Like that. I don't score things. I just write rock songs. And they're like, no.
Batman, well, so
that
yeah,
was
he did
after Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
This is Pee-wee's Big Adventure was in 85.
That was his
and
first
I actually
one.
Have a
That's
list
crazy
of we can
that
go
was
down
his
memory
first score.
Yeah, right? I know. And that movie is so
That's
good.
Pretty great. Yeah.
I will go down the list real quick. I'll skip some, but there's a good memory lane here. We'll get to revisit some fun titles. I'll go quickly. But so there's Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Skipping a few. Big Top Pee-wee, Scrooged, Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands, Dick Tracy, Batman Returns, and then Nightmare Before Christmas in 93, and there's some in between there. And then he goes on to do Black Beauty, Mission Impossible, Mars Attacks, Men in Black, Flubber, Good Will Hunting... what's another good one? Sleepy Hollow, Planet of the Apes, Men in Black 2, Spider-Man, The Hulk, Red Dragon, Big Fish, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Corpse Bride, Charlotte Webb, Nacho Libre, Meet the Robinsons, Milk, Hellboy 2, Terminator Salvation, I think it's Salvation. The other, Alice in Wonderland, I'm kind of going through a bunch, Dark Shadow, Silver Linings Playbook, Frankenweenie, The Oz Movie, American Hustle. Yeah, but it's just crazy how many movies, like, I would know we know all the classic ones, but he has done so many scores for so many movies. And it's just crazy. When I saw the list, I was like, really? 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 So anyway, apparently he's going to also do the score for Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, for anyone who cares, which I didn't know either. So
that's kinda cool. That is really cool.
So yeah, anyway, so he's he was the composer, and he was singing all of the parts for everything as he was coming up with the music and the demos for the music, and like, here's the next song, here's the next song, and they're literally like, great, we'll take it, like, we can finally start storyboarding something. And he ended up through the process of that getting really attached to singing the part of Jack. And they always intended on hiring someone else because he's not necessarily a vocalist, even though he literally is a lead singer in a band. He's not like a, you know, the style of this musical sort of operatic thing. It's not his forte. So it wasn't intended to be him originally, but he got really attached to it. And as they were considering people, he apparently kind of put his hat in the ring. Was like, you know, it would be kind of cool, very timidly. And Tim Burton was like, you got the part. Don't worry about it. It's totally yours. And so, yeah, but he does not voice all of the dialogue lines for Jack. That's another actor, which I can't remember his name, but he played his name King Humphrey or something. King Humperdinck.
Chris Sarandon.
Sarandon.
Chris Sarandon. Chris Sarandon. There you go.
Let me go ahead and play this little clip from that documentary on Netflix, that documentary series, The Movies That Made Us. It's just Danny Elfman talking a little bit more about the music and the part. So,
well, the pressure was on Danny Elfman to keep churning out the tunes.
For these initial demos, which is what went to Henry, I recorded all the voices, every voice.
So when it came time to record the masters, they'd probably want to bring in the masters.
There's better singers than me.
Don't mention that to Oingo Boingo fans.
Oingo Boingo!
But by the time Tim and I went into the studio to officially record all the songs, I was really attached to singing Jack's parts.
And for Danny, there was a good reason.
Jack was an extension of what I was feeling at the time. A lead singer in a band is like a king of their own little world. But I was at the point where I didn't want to be in a band anymore.
So as Danny was writing Jack's lyrics,
I was writing from my own heart. He's got all these fans and people love him, but he's not happy.
Year after year, it's the same routine. And I grow so weary of the sound of screams.
So when it came time to choose the voice for Jack, Danny spoke up.
Danny, don't worry about it. You got the part.
We'll stop it there. So he got the part to be both the speaking voice and the singing voice. But after he recorded all the speaking voice parts, they were like, he wasn't very good at that. He wasn't a good voice actor. So that's when they asked Chris Sarandon to come in and do it. Which is funny because I associate all of Jack with Danny Elfman. I forget that it's someone else who does the speaking parts. But I guess like true Nightmare Before Christmas fans know that, because later in the documentary, Chris Sarandon is interviewed and he's like, people come up to me all the time telling me how much they love Jack and how I've like saved their lives by being Jack. Because people are just so attached to that character. Think of all the weirdo kids out there who like relate to Jack and him not feeling like he belongs, and especially Sally. And so
there. Like, it's crazy. There's like what, 6 or 7 songs. Every one of these songs is an earworm.
There's more than that.
Will get stuck in your head. Well, and even the like instrumental pieces of music. What are the songs? It's well, This Is Halloween, Jack's Lament, What's This? The Town Meeting song, Something's Up with Jack, Sally's song, Making Christmas, Kidnap the Santa Claus, the second Jack's, and that's it. Oh, that's like...
You skipped Oogie Boogie, Kidnap Santa Claus.
Oh, shoot. I said...
Poor Jack.
How did I skip Oogie Boogie?
And then Sally's song, and then Jack and Sal. That's like 13 songs.
But like, some of them are the same. Jack's Lament and Poor Jack are like the same melody. So it was like Sally's song and Jack and Sally.
Yeah.
They're not the same melody.
Well, okay.
Jack and Sally's song is a reprise of Sally's song. It's literally just called Reprise at the end on the soundtrack. So that one is, I guess, but all three of Jack's songs are different. Four.
Okay.
There's like four Jack songs. Anyways, we'll get a little more into that later. Let's get into the actual movie. We always talk about the animation style. Obviously, we already talked a lot about the complexities of the stop motion animation. But just overall thoughts on the way it looks and just the way it was done.
For the overall animation style, I think it's like one of the greatest achievements in animation ever. Like, I really think, groundbreaking. I mean, we've all seen and we're all, I mean, that's why, like, even part of the marketing was just like behind the scenes of how they made this, because it's just so unbelievable. Like, the singularity of the style mixed with the difficulty of how they made it and the characters.
Yeah.
So, you know how like a gate would open or things would happen? Wasn't that animation, not stop animation? Were only the people?
Oh, it's all stop animation.
No.
There are certain.
All of it was made out of clay or something.
There are certain effects like ghosts that fly by or fire or lightning or even shadows, apparently, in this thing I watched. But yeah, no, like the gates. The camera movements, all of that.
There's a mechanical thing, you know, ratcheting up and down. All that was...
Yeah, like they had to build the sets so that an animator could be tucked up somewhere to do something mechanical that way and you wouldn't see them.
I'm just amazed, just even hearing you guys talking about it. I'd like to see, you know, maybe you could post on this podcast, Kelly, but a great link to how is stop animation done, or an example from, because it just sounds so antiquated and it comes out so smooth.
It does.
I'm fascinated by this. And I don't
there are moments where you're just like, that looks like it's really moving. Like, there are other moments where you can kind of see the jerkiness a little bit, because, you know, how would you, but yeah, there's some time, I think it's in what's this, where he's like pulling down on a rope of lights with his like little umbrella thing that he's floated down for, and it just looks like it's literally a cord being pulled down. Like, there's no like jerkiness to the motion. It's so, anyway, it's just amazing how they made it seem so live.
The shot right before he goes into Christmas Town of the doorknob reflecting him,
oh yeah,
to grab it, and the trees behind him, apparently that was like a huge undertaking to get that right. But it's just crystal clear. It's amazing what they did with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not drawing.
I love those little puff clouds that are coming out of the train.
Me too. I noticed that.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Super cool. I'd also say that this was my first time watching the movie in HD, and that was like sort of like different than what I remember, just because it always is when you watch something in HD. Anyways, I felt there was even some moments when it looked like it was happening right in front of me. Like, it was so crystal. I mean, it was committed to film, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's real light hitting a real object.
Exactly.
Being filmed onto celluloid. So there's, like, an appreciation you get for all the work that went into it and the real physical nature of it that you, like, not even knowing that, you can kind of get this glow from it that's different than animation. But when you do know it and you watch the movie, you just have this background appreciation for all the work that went into it. So it just kind of raises everything up a little bit in your mind, which, you know, these computer animated movies we've spent so long talking about, you know, hours and hours and tons of technological innovation goes into that. But somehow it's all sort of mysterious stuff that we can't really understand. We don't know how they actually animate on those computers. We don't know like how that technology was actually made, but we can envision trying to do it ourselves, trying to actually move a little model and take a picture and going and moving it again. So just like the appreciation of all the work that went into it, I think resonates with all of us because it's so practical. Yeah.
Great point.
The other crazy thing too is like, if they filmed a sequence and one shadow was wrong or I forget what exactly could have gone wrong, but like if one little thing went wrong, they would literally have to do it all over again. Whereas like if there's like one little like spot on one piece of a, you know, 2D animated film, they could just like erase that one slide or like cover, like paint it back over and just refilm it. Whereas with this, they had to redo it. And so I would just like cry like for a day, I feel like, if I was one of these animators and spent a week on like 1 minute and they're like, you have to do it all over again. which apparently happened a few times. And the animators were like, yeah, every time we went back to look, it would just be like, is it fine? Or are we going to have to do this all over again? I can't even imagine that.
I was going to say, like, one thing that I was, because I've been thinking about the music and now the animation. And I can remember, like, some of the first times I watched the movie, I didn't even really listen to the lyrics. I was just so absorbed by the visuals of the animation. And that still kind of stands, like, the lyrics are good, but they're kind of pedestrian. You know, he's just saying, yeah, I feel sad and now I'm mad. And it's, I feel like it's a kind of a good marriage of just, you know, being able to not necessarily focus on every single word. And that just sort of opens up your other senses to take all the animation in. Hmm.
I highly disagree with that statement, and I will talk more about that later.
Cool. I'm down.
All right. Into it.
No apologies.
That's our new motto.
Something that's really cool is the portrayal difference between Halloween Town versus Christmas, or it's Halloween Land and Christmas Town, technically, is what they're called. But anyways,
is it?
Yeah.
I thought it was Halloween Town. Oh, no, that's the other movie.
That's a different movie.
That's the Disney Channel original.
a different movie.
God damn it.
But, so Christmas Town is still very Tim Burton-y looking, but it's obviously brighter. There's more colors. There's a lot more rounded edges and things. Whereas Halloween Town, sorry, I just said it, Halloween Land, apparently Tim Burton wanted a 3-color palette. He said it could be black, white, or orange. There can be no other colors, which is why it's so dark. And he also said no right angles. Nothing can be symmetrical, which is why all the buildings are like curved and really weird. And it's so Tim Burton. And we're so used to what Tim Burton stuff looks like. But it's, I always like there, when you watch the movie, when you get to what's this, there is this sense of like slight calm that comes over me because there's more colors and there's the rounded edges.
It's so effective.
But it's still so Tim Burton, and it's still so appropriate to the film. So I just think they did a really good job with the contracts between those two. Something else I didn't notice until this time watching it is when he goes to the forest and finds all the holiday doors, that each door has a little thing right under it that's sort of like a step that relates to the holiday. So like the Christmas door has a present under it. The Thanksgiving door with the turkey has like a pilgrim's hat under it. The Easter door just has more eggs under it. The shamrock door has little mushrooms under it. And I don't remember what's under the Valentine's Day door, but I never noticed that before.
Can you believe they included St. Patrick's Day? I'm like, no offense to anyone that celebrates St. Patrick's Day. But I was just so surprised. I was like, all these, like, I don't know, otherwise.
Yeah, like, invited that holiday. One.
Well, and it's clearly rooted in America. There's a Thanksgiving one with a turkey. So this is like an American-based thing, for sure.
I mean, it's based on Tim Burton's childhood with holidays. So
he grew up in
Southern California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there isn't a 4th of July one that I recall.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That'd be like the worst land of all.
That would be bad.
Oh, my God.
So just America? You just come to America.
Wow.
Well, the question is, where is this forest of doors? And like, how did Jack get there? He was just walking through the woods. And like, so if someone came from Christmas Town, could they end up in the same spot?
Here's what I also noticed this time is that they don't show us how Jack gets back to Halloween.
They do. I noticed it this time. I noticed it. Actually, he doesn't come back from Christmas Time. Not from Christmas Town. I'm sorry. We just hear Zero barking and they arrive. But when he you know, they make the sleigh and everything, and he flies over to the real world, I guess, is a different place. I learned through watching, like, preparing for this. Yeah, like, the real world is maybe where all the trees are. I don't know. But he's delivering all those presents to kids in the real world, and then he gets shot down. And then he actually, he lands on that statue. He's given his reprise of his soliloquy. He realizes he's Jack. And then he walks down into, like, a crypt.
Yeah.
A crypt door and a grave. And he walks out and then he comes out in Halloween Town. So that's just another way of traveling too. You can walk through the land of the dead or something.
But that's a connection from the real world back to Halloween Land. They don't show, I mean, I guess we're just left to assume that there's doors in the forest of Christmas Town.
But he flew there too. He flew to the real world.
I know. It's
just all over the place.
Yeah, it's not very succinct, though. That's because when he goes through the door from Halloween Land to Christmas Town, he just like appears in the snow. They don't show him flying through a wooden door in the woods to get there.
Well, it's magic, first of all.
Pulls him into the door, Kelly.
That part in the Truman Show when he's like at the edge of the horizon and at a little door there, you know? That's what I picture it looking like.
Yeah.
Like their world's shining here so they can leave it.
You know, it's funny, Byron, you mentioned that St. Patrick's Day door. Apparently, the sequel that they proposed was going to be Jack going through the St. Patrick's Day door.
That is so dumb.
So yeah, dumb. There was just a title apparently that was leaked or something.
It was like
the Unlucky Clover or something.
Yes,
like that.
Was that real? That was this is real.
Jack Skellington and the Unlucky Clover.
I don't know if it's just a rumor. It came across on one of the YouTube things we were watching, getting ready for this. Yeah.
Well, they definitely proposed a sequel.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was either that's what I heard. It was also gonna maybe be the Thanksgiving door. But it
but
wasn't
I mean,
going to be the
how
Easter.
Badly do you want to look think, through all those doors?
You think the That's one that makes so cool the most it. Sense as a sequel, though, would have been the Easter door because the Easter bunny does show up in this one. So
Easter is like too risky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
I guess it's Christmas,
they get with Christmas, which is, I mean, whatever.
They're both Christian Christmas. Holidays. Interesting.
Yeah, they were the pagan holidays first.
They were.
I know. But I don't think Easter's any more risky in terms of that than Christmas. It's just that Christmas is more beloved and it's more acceptable to have the non-Christian symbols, you know.
Right, the secular so Christmas.
And children still want to believe in Santa Claus and all that.
And the fact that like a skeleton is coming with like heads and boxes to Christmas land. Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, I just really want to see Thanksgiving land. I don't know why. I'm so curious.
It's probably a fucking mess of genocide.
Probably.
That is so good.
Yes.
Oh my
Not at all
God.
What I was picturing.
I really want to see this.
Thanksgiving land
my God.
It would be like Westworld. Kitchen.
Yeah, it would be like Westworld, absolutely.
It would be it would be making of the food and setting of the tables and that kind of thing.
Breaking of the treaties.
You know, weird families.
Yes.
Yeah. Awkward conversations and touch football and like
racist uncles,
weird dogs. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think though that if you think about the St. Patrick's Day thing though, you could get on the like, you know, the leprechauns bring the gold and the shamrocks and the roses. And then Jack's like, that sounds great. And then he messes that up too. I don't know. Same thing with the Easter Bunny. The Easter Bunny is basically Santa Claus. He just doesn't go down a chimney and he hides it in your bushes in your backyard.
The best character in the whole movie. The zombie murdered with an axe, whose only line in the whole movie is,
Bunny!
You know, he actually was going to have a singing line, but they cut it out of the film for time in one of the songs. Fun fact.
Okay.
Okay, so something we also always talk about after Animation Cell's opening scene, and this movie has one of the best opening scenes probably in any movie with This Is Halloween. Like, you're just fully immersed. I mean, first of all, well, I guess it starts with a very brief narration of the doors, but...
Yeah.
But...
That's very intriguing.
It is, but then it goes to a plain black screen and then slowly zooms in on just one jack-o'-lantern. And for a while, it's just black background with the different characters. And then you're into Halloween Town with the song.
You're literally like going through the portal, like.
Yeah.
That's
a good, I never thought of it like that. You are. You're like, do they open the door in the beginning narration?
I think so. That's what I'm picturing.
Yes,
in my
they
head.
Do. They do. Right. They do. They do. They do. They do open the door. You're right, Jimmy. They do. That is. Yes. I never really realized that. Thank you. They do open the door to the pumpkin. And then it's him going like through the portal. And yes. It's so good. That song, it just like, I feel like every Halloween playlist out there, the first song on it is This Is Halloween, right? Like, what other song would you start your Halloween playlist with?
Thriller.
No, you end it with that, baby.
Or Monster Mash.
Monster Mash.
Monster Mash. There we go.
No, that's like number eight, you know, like when you're like getting really loosey-goosey.
No, that's okay, when you this put is on just, Tyler.
Kelly, I don't know.
Kelly's like, you're all wrong.
Yeah, you do not know how to make playlists, and I'm sorry.
I thought a lot about my Halloween playlists. Okay, so going back to the whole Tim Burton, Danny Elfman relationship, Tim Burton also brought back some actors that he has worked with a lot in the past. So Byron, you want to share some of our notable voice actors in this film?
Sure. Yeah, so if anybody has seen Beetlejuice, Catherine O'Hara plays Sally. Catherine O'Hara in the movie and Beetlejuice was the mother of the house.
And I just say, I just found that out like earlier this year. That like blew my mind. I was like, what? Sally? I have no idea.
Really? You didn't know that?
Catherine O'Hara. Yeah, I just didn't know.
I mean, her voice is so soft and she's sort of like breathy, voicey, singing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I didn't even recognize her voice.
I know. Glenn Shaddix plays the mayor. And Glenn Shaddix was Catherine O'Hara's husband in Beetlejuice. So, real connection there. Paul Rubens.
Catherine O'Hara's husband was Jeffrey Jones.
Excuse me.
No, he Glenn was Shaddix his, was like, the, hit like, her, the, like, the, best friend, owner, buddy,
consultant.
Designer.
Yes, also, not her husband. He was the guy that,
yes.
Like,
the designer.
But
the
who designer. Also knows how to run a seance. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
Clairvoyant interior decorator.
Yes, they're clairvoyant interior. There's probably like 16 of those that you can find on Twitter right now, I guarantee you.
Seriously.
Paul Rubens, as we talked about, plays Locke, so connection there. Greg Proops plays Harlequin Demon. You probably recognize Greg Proops from some comedy that you've seen on TV. Ken Page playing Oogie Boogie, one of my favorite performances in the movie. Chris Sarandon also plays Jack Skellington, as we talked about. Chris Sarandon. William Hickey plays the evil scientist. I have no idea who that is. And everyone else, you know, not too many big names, but just some crossover between Beetlejuice and Pee Wee's Playhouse. There we go.
The sandworms from Beetlejuice are one of the
The sandworms is the one that's eating the Christmas tree. Yeah. That's real. I always thought that was a thing, but apparently Tim Burton really was put that snake
in there. That's very on purpose.
Yes.
Yeah.
This needs the sandworms in there. Yeah.
Fun fact about Ken Page. You know how Jimmy and I used to have season tickets to the La Mirada Theater?
Yeah.
They did the musical version of Grumpy Old Men, and he was one of the Grumpy Old Men singing on stage. So we saw him at the La Mirada Theater. Isn't that crazy?
Awesome.
Oogie Boogie. Yep.
Oogie Boogie
himself.
Did
you know that going into it, or did you like read the program and see that he was listed?
Knew that because my mom kept talking about it because she was very excited because we saw it with my parents. So
yeah.
I wouldn't have known if my mom hadn't told me. So I'll
did you get his autograph?
No. I didn't. I think so. You're right.
He also
it was
did,
a Wednesday
like, his
night.
Role
it was
like, in the Hollywood Bowl shows they do and stuff. And like Danny Elfman sings Jack and Catherine.
They
O'Hara
all come back.
Sally.
They all like, come they back all... to do it live on stage anytime.
One of those things. I feel like someone's going to retire or die or something. I'm just going to miss it. Still never seen it. Feel like I
know. I
it.
Feel like next time they do that, we should go. Like, okay. All right. So obviously one of the biggest themes of this movie is, well, there's obviously the holiday theme of Halloween and Christmas, but the really underlying theme of this movie, I think, is Jack's internal struggle, you know? And I think the message at the end of the day is being true to yourself. You know, and also that it's okay to question yourself. It's okay to not be sure of yourself and what you're doing and finding yourself again. Any thoughts on that?
There's I've seen a lot of different interpretations of the story. People read a lot of different interpretations out of it. I think at the end of the day, I think that it's not that big a deal. I think the point of this movie is the animation and the music.
Yep.
I think.
I mean, they literally had no story. When they set out to make this movie, there was no story. There was no point other than an art style. And yeah, I mean, that's literally it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just it's a really creepy, awesome romance about outsiders. And I think that's sort of it for me.
Okay. Well, you just mentioned romance, which was something I was going to bring up. I know you just mentioned they made this with no real story or script, but then my question is if the theme I said you guys think isn't really a theme, then is the underlying theme just the love story?
I'm sorry. I think what you said is a theme of the movie that kind of, evolved out of the creative process of making it. But I don't think it's like goes very deep or it's like worth analyzing that much. I didn't mean to indicate that I don't think there is a theme of accepting who you are, because there definitely is. And Jack has to learn that. He has to learn that he is the Pumpkin King and he's really good at what he does. And like you said, like he got to have a great experience. He acknowledges in his song by kissing the sky or whatever and getting to see what is out there beyond his own world. And then he got to kind of come back to himself and felt more empowered as him. He got him out of his funk, you know, to go out and see something else and kind of come back like a semester abroad or something.
Yeah, it's also interesting to think about what Danny Elfman was saying about how he was dealing with this in real life. And he was sort of totally like echoing his own experience as a person. Like that to me is like maybe the biggest present undercurrent of the film for me is somebody struggling to break out of a certain cycle and find something beyond themselves. That feels like intrinsic to the movie to me. It's sort of, but you know, thinking about like why people love it, I think it is like it is something that people can find acceptance of themselves and acceptance. You know, these otherwise spooky characters or characters that are behaving in a certain way that's outside their normal behavior, they come to grow and they come to, you know. See, now I almost feel like I'm constructing a theme.
I know, right? So that's the thing.
That's what this sounds like to me. I mean, if anything, this movie's about like, don't try to take somebody else's shit. You know, he wants to take over his Christmas. And he learns, well, that didn't work. You guys are much deeper thinkers, I guess, or, you know, you're just
an emotional
response to
that's
the movie.
That's how we started.
I don't know if I'm sure those themes are true and we could write a thesis about them, but to me it was more about sort of his hubris and his assuming he could just go and do Christmas better, you know? Yeah. And so he gets the lock, stock, and barrel to go kidnap Santa Claus, which is really funny and very brilliant. And then he's going to do it. And he doesn't even realize when they're shooting, you know, missiles at him that they're shooting at him.
He
doesn't ever realize that the children are afraid of him. He doesn't ever realize he's a failure really till the end, and he ends up falling down
he doesn't
down
realize
in the
Sally loves
the
him
arms of an angel, you know, and then has this great catharsis, which I thought was like Shakespeare abridged. I mean, something
it's
like
so
something,
abridged.
You know, something needed to happen between the fall and the realization that you know, he messed up and he has to go home. And sorry, guys.
And he flips on a dime. No, that scene, I know. That scene is like, it starts out like so lamentful, like, what did I do? What did I? And like in the course of a minute, he's like, oh no, but it was great. And then he's just like happy and jumps up. It's part of what I love about his character is his never ending confidence. But I think you nailed it. Like that confidence goes to the point of hubris and he has to learn a lesson from it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So question, when he's delivering the presents and they're also shooting at him and the police are getting called, like where exactly is that? That's not Christmas Town. That's like
it's in the real world.
The real world, right?
Apparently, okay.
That's that our
he figures
world
out how to get to somehow.
See, as a child,
we talked about this already.
As a youth,
holidays, people from a holiday town can access the real world.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, do they provide the holiday, like the way Santa Claus presumably delivers toys to all the people in the real world from, like, you know, he's coming from Christmas Town to do that. Do the people in Halloween Town like bring Halloween to the real world, and Halloween world, Halloween land.
They bring the spookies.
Yeah, they bring the spookies.
That's how
yeah.
I interpret it. So I interpret the very beginning of this movie when they're all singing like "This is Halloween" is them all like returning back to Halloween land from the real world. Like Halloween night just happened. They were out scaring people with the trick or treaters, and they just came back and they're like, "That was such a great Halloween. We did a great job again this year." That's how
I never got that until like this recent reviewing. I thought they had just had their own little Halloween in their own little land, whatever.
And like it somehow like through the power of their celebration, like transcends the barriers.
But I also agree, Jimmy, it is interesting how in this universe, I mean, you know, I don't think we have any children listening. Sorry to burst your bubble, but Santa Claus is not real.
In this
universe, Santa Claus literally does bring the presents for Christmas, you know, and
for sure. It's all about our fantasies about holidays. There's no, you know. Easter Bunny's not real, and talking pumpkins aren't real, and boogeymen aren't real. But, you know, it's our childhood nostalgia, and there's something very endearing about embracing those ideas.
So I want to go back to what Byron mentioned earlier, and I was kind of asking about is the love story side of it with Sally. Like, because something I noticed as a kid, but then in recent years, I'm just so into the music and everything like we talked about and like the art direction. But like Sally and Santa Claus even says it at the very end where he's like, she's the only one who makes any sense in this insane asylum. Like Sally, the whole movie is like, this is wrong. Don't do that. Like, and she's like,
was so worried about Jack leaving. You guys, this was the first time I saw this movie.
That is crazy.
I tell you, the first time today, ever. Yeah. I mean, I recognize the characters in the great Tim Burton style, especially, you know, the moon and the Pumpkin King's silhouette and that great curlicue mountain. Well, it's behind you there, Jimmy, in your street thing. My point being is that, what did you just say, Kelly? I was reiterating it.
About Sally's character.
Is that how she's the one saying the whole time.
She was so worried about Jack.
She's the only one going, you can't go take Christmas. She's the only one worried about it.
And I didn't know how she had that wisdom or what warned her.
There's a scene where she has a vision where she's like picking a flower. And it turns into a Christmas tree.
Christmas,
she's all happy. And then it like bursts into flames. And then she's all like, okay, I had a vision. And she tries to tell him like, don't do it, don't do it. And she even says like, I hope my premonition doesn't come true. And it does.
No, see, it had no significance because we didn't know about her. I didn't know anything. Yeah. Why
it's not fleshed out.
I agree that little scene does sort of come out of nowhere with her character. So it's like, she's like a Frankenstein doll, really, is what she is. But like, she's also clairvoyant or a witch. Like, I don't know. Like, it does kind of not really make sense a little bit. But I mean, they had to have someone be her character. So I heard a quote earlier, and it's interesting. You guys should watch that episode of that Netflix show about this movie. But the person that ended up writing the screenplay is a woman. I forget her name right now, but Sally was always a character, but she was more of like a Jessica Rabbit almost type character, like this like sexy girlfriend, just like the girl in town. And the screenwriter is like not that type of person. She is basically a Sally, and she was actually dating Danny Elfman at the time. And she's the one who really fleshed out Sally as a character and made Sally who she is. And Danny Elfman's the one who really brought Jack to life. So they are literally like Jack and Sally in real life in a way. It's really interesting. But she's the one who's like, no, Sally needs to be like this. And so there's a quote that said, Danny Elfman's the one who gave the movie its life. But the screenwriter's name, I should look her up. I can't remember her name right now. But the screenwriter is the one who gave the movie its heart. By adding Sally in there through Sally. And honestly, that ending scene at the end, when Jack finally is like accepting and he's like over it, the Christmas thing. And he just finally goes, and says, "Hey, Sally, like, I want to be with you." And it's watching it this time, I was almost just like, you know, if Jack had just noticed Sally in this movie, he would have never been so obsessed with the Christmas thing because he would have just been focused on her. But he couldn't. He couldn't notice Sally trying to talk to him and be with him because he was so obsessed with taking over Christmas. I don't know.
Well, she didn't make it easy for him. And even when she sent him like a bottle of wine and some kind of food up on a rope from the bottom of the tower, remember that scene? And then he cares more about the wine, opens it, looks out the window, she's gone. I mean, she didn't. There was nothing.
But it's right. It's right after that scene.
I knew that he loved her before. No way.
Yeah. No.
Well, he didn't really.
He tries to tell her. He tries to tell her. I'm. It's crazy that I never noticed you there before. And then someone interrupts him.
Oh, that's right.
Wait, Grace. Yeah. Okay.
Earlier in the movie, he tries to tell her like she's. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't remember. But he says to her like, I just, how could I have not have seen you there all along or something like that? And then somebody interrupts him about like Christmas or something else. Hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
I think it's when he's passing. I think it's when he's like passing out all the jobs to everyone in town to like make Christmas. Maybe. And he's like, oh, Sally, you're here. I want you to make my Santa Claus suit for me. Yeah. Basically. I think it's that scene. And he goes, I never noticed that blah, blah, blah. You're going to be perfect for this. And then, yeah, someone's like, it's probably the mayor. Jack, oh, like, something's wrong.
About to be a very loving moment. So he could have been, you know, trying to tell her then.
But Cynthia, it's right after she gives him the basket of wine that she has that vision.
Says, I never know. Okay.
But I'm just saying, it's.
You see the movie, but first time you do miss a few things. But it's also a very real reaction, right? Because this is what the movie gave me. In a one go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's different when you watch this movie forever and you're obsessed with the movie and have nostalgia and you love Jack and Sally as this creepy Halloween couple that so many people like, you know? But I did have that thought though, like at the end of this watching, like, you know, is it a love story? No, it's not really, but I don't know. You could, like you said, Cynthia, we could write theses on all these points and have an argument, but you know, you have to really look for it and go there if you want to go there.
I will say, while we're on the subject of the romance and Sally, like that moment at the end when they walk into the moon, like it was very romantic to me watching it this time. I think it has to do with the contrast, which we already talked about, like in reference to Christmas Town. But like, well, first of all, I love that melody so much. I'm obsessed with it recently. Like, I didn't realize how much I liked it until this recent viewing. But when it came, I liked it when Sally sang it, and then it came back and they walk and they finally meet. And it's got this swelling orchestral thing that is so much more consonant than all the dissonant stuff we heard earlier. And anyway, blah, 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 blah. I like that part a lot. That's all I'm really trying to say. Yeah,
you know, it really like got to me a little bit more than it ever has too, for some reason. I wonder why. Again, I think it's because like this is the first time I've really tried to sit and watch this movie and critique it, you know, as opposed to just like, I love this movie. And like, I'm not really paying attention to it. I'm just singing the songs, you know, like, but yeah, that ending scene is really, really good. I agree, though, like it would have been better to have maybe fleshed out their relationship a little bit more. Like, were they friends at all before? Maybe not. Like Sally just because at the very beginning that this is Halloween song, she's sort of in the background looking at him with like googly eyes, you know, so maybe he didn't really like he knew she was, but he never really like Gray said that one scene, he didn't really notice her.
She's supposed to be locked up in her tower, right?
Yeah.
If the guy could have his way.
Why did that happen? Why did he lock her up?
He made her.
Yeah.
Because he made her and she keeps escaping and he's like, no, you can't leave your mind. You must be my like slave and servant.
That was shallow too. I mean, you remember in Into the Woods, you know, Meryl Streep's character keeps Rapunzel because she needs the daughter to love her and all that. I mean, that was something. But this movie, I didn't really know why he kept her up there.
Because she's Frankenstein. Monsters, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
You guys are smarter than me.
We've only seen it like 10 times.
Yeah. More than 10 times. I watch this every year for Halloween, like my whole life. So I've watched this more than 30 times at this point, probably. And I listened to the soundtrack pretty obsessively when I was in middle school, like everyone was in middle school. So I've heard the music and songs like so much, which is now, I guess, a good segue to go back to getting into depth with the song. So like Daniel mentioned earlier, there is like a solid, I'm going to count all the reprises. Okay. Because to me, reprises are still different moments in a movie. There's like 12 or 13 songs, right? So there's This Is Halloween, which goes directly into Jack's lament. What's This is pretty directly after that. So like, again, this movie is like song after song after song at the beginning, because that's what they started with, which, you know, it's really cool to me. Then we get the town meeting song when Jack comes back and just trying to explain to the town what Christmas is. Then it's Jack's obsession when he's like, you know, something's up with Jack. I think it's that song. Kidnap Santa Claus, Making Christmas, Oogie Boogie song, Sally song, Jack's song in the cemetery, which I guess is called Poor Jack. And then the finale with him and Sally. So Byron said something earlier that I said I disagreed with, where he said the songs are just wordy. Or they're just words. Do you remember exactly what you said?
Pedestrian, that the lyrics aren't particularly poetic.
I felt that they're a little off kilter, the sort of Danny Elfman style. He picks like an odd word choice, but I still feel that they're not, I don't know what the word is. They're just, they're easy. They're easy to digest. And
witty. They're not intellectually captivating. Hamilton, for example, right? They're just, you know, some lyrics are, the mind trips out on how brilliant the rhyme is, or the anti-rhyme, or the concepts. This is, I think pedestrian was the right word, actually.
It's easy to understand for a young child.
Mm-hmm. I totally disagree. There are so many little words and rhymes that he throws in here. Like specifically, I can think of a few off the top of my head, but there's one line. I mean, I love all the songs and What's This is so good, but there's the line where he goes when he's singing along and he's like, no little things to scream and snare them or scare them. Only little cozy things secure inside their dreamland, is like so quick and like, those little rhymes he puts in there.
Internal rhymes in that.
I think it's brilliant. And I think all of Jack's songs in particular are so operatic. Yes. And like, Jack's songs are my favorite songs in this movie. Like, I don't think they're pedestrian. I think they are like, and you know, hearing that clip from Danny Elfman going like, I was really pouring like my heart and soul and what I was feeling in my life at the time into them. Like, you can hear that in the words. And sure, they're not like, you don't, I guess it's
just to clarify really quick. I don't mean that the songs are poorly written or that they're not well constructed. It's just that in relationship to the visuals, I could focus on the visuals more than I needed to focus on the words, if that makes sense.
Okay, well, have you ever listened to the soundtrack and like read the lyrics along with it? I'm sure you haven't. But do that, because I feel like it'll change your opinion.
It's watching the movie right now.
But the music, we're talking about the songs in the movie, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so I watched it with subtitles on this time, and I definitely caught way more than I would have if I just listened to it. But there was times when I enjoyed not looking at the subtitles more than looking at the subtitles, because I'm just more intrigued by the visuals, and that's just me. So, yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, who wouldn't be? I mean, because it's such a great visual movie, but I don't think that because you're more into the visuals means the songs are not as good, if that makes sense.
He was appreciating, I think, that the lyrics were more straightforward or simple to understand. But I know what you're saying too, Kelly. They're at times very complicated and very quick and rattled off in a way that, honestly, they're not even that memorable to me. The lyrics, you know, it's all about the mood.
Yeah, I completely agree. Especially like the way the repetition of the melodies. Da 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 da. I mean, it's well designed and it's like affected and it has an aesthetic to it, but it's not like complicated. It doesn't take me. I kind of can expect the next movement each time they're going into it.
I feel like this music all sounds the same.
Mm. There is a point in this movie, I think it's when they're doing Making Christmas, yeah, where I'm just like, okay, oh my God. Like, I've heard so much of this, like, dun, 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 that Dies Irae, you know, like,
it's... Somebody's always singing something,
Yeah, yeah. It does have a very familiar ring throughout, but that's why I love the contrasting moments so much. And I don't want to skip ahead, but I know what you're saying, Grace. I agree with that. But I do think there are very effective moments where they break that. Yeah.
I mean, I agree with that. Because I, too, when we get to Making Christmas, my ears are a little bit like, okay. Like, Making Christmas is a little bit like, just kind of slow. It's not really a slow song, but there's something about it that kind of, you start to feel a slowness in the movie for a second. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The movie slows down.
But Oogie Boogie song.
Love it.
I always want... It's pretty soon after. It's after Making Christmas. Yeah. The next song after Making Christmas.
Okay.
It's oh my God, I was obsessed with this song because I wanted to play it in jazz band so bad back in in high school. No. Aww. And I've never even looked up if there is like a high school version of this song to play. I'm sure there is. It's probably pretty hard though. It's a pretty complicated song.
Do you think your students, high school students, you know, are watching this movie?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, you guys. Every year, every single year, a student says, Miss, can we do a Nightmare Before Christmas marching band show? And every year I say, no, everyone does that.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, I haven't seen anyone do it for a while. But, okay, I'm not going to get into the...
Come on.
I'm not going to get into the nitty-grittiness of marching bands and how that works, but that's all.
That's right.
But I'm just saying,
podcast.
All of my students everywhere love this movie. Are you kidding? I would say like once a day I see at least one student walking around campus with a Jack Skellington shirt on. And I'm sure that is true at any high school campus. Like, and every year you see at least like three people dressed as Jack Skellington or Sally anywhere in the world or anywhere you are on Halloween. Like those
when
costumes
Disney
are forever.
Asked, like, who is this movie for? And they changed it to Touchstone and all that. Like, the answer is, like, tweens and teens. Like, kids dealing with, like, somewhat dark emotions for the first time. And just, like, it's still childish enough for them to have an easy access point into this kind of dark aesthetic, you know, early on, like 12 or whatever, and then it sticks with them. It could even come earlier, but, yeah. That's who it's for. I mean, that's who it affects the most.
Yeah, like when you find out that books and culture can be creepy and it's okay. It's like, oh, I like the creepy one. Yeah.
Right. Also, a lot of my students like love horror movies. Like more than I felt like kids did when I was in high school. And not just because I don't like horror movies, because I have friends who love horror movies. But it's interesting. All right, well... time for a few more fun facts we didn't get into. Jack's suit and costume was originally going to be all black, but it was Henry Selick's idea to add the white pinstripes so that he would stand out a little bit more in Halloweenland because Halloweenland is so dark. And that's such a like quintessential part of his costume, those pinstripes, thin ones. So that was all Henry Selick's idea, apparently. in addition to the turning the doorknob on the tree, like Gray said, was like the hardest thing for them to film. The second hardest thing for them to film was when Oogie Boogie's costume rips off and all the bugs are just, he's just bugs. Yeah. That was like super hard. They
how
didn't
is
even
that
explain
not a bunch how, of bugs. Like,
okay, yeah, sorry, all right. I have a tangent.
That was claymation.
I have a lot of questions about Oogie Boogie.
Let's talk about Oogie Boogie.
What is he? What is his relationship to the rest of Halloween Land? Because yeah. Jack doesn't like him.
Right.
We know from a line earlier. He's right. Like not he has ill repute in Halloween Town. But yet Jack still asks his henchmen to kidnap Santa Claus. It's really right. weird. I guess he is supposed to be like he is the boogeyman. Which is like even more evil than the evilest of Halloween. Like that was my interpretation as a kid. He also is the shadow on a moonlit night. He has a very distinctive, I don't know what like animal or creature he's supposed to be, but he's made of
bugs. Like
I always had like,
okay, here's what
that's
I heard.
I kind of think.
I agree with everything you said, Daniel. That was my interpretation always as a kid growing up watching this. And I think I just heard this on like a YouTube video. So this could just be someone else's interpretation and not really what Tim Burton was going for. But the idea is that he's like a sack of what you don't want on Halloween. Everyone wants a sack of candy, but he's the opposite of that, which is a sack of bugs. So he's like the worst thing you could get on Halloween is someone's interpretation.
Or like the dark side of Halloween. I don't know.
But apparently Tim Burton said that this movie has no villains, that all the Halloween creatures are just their normal Halloween self. There's even a line in This Is Halloween where they go, but we're not mean. Like, we're not mean. We're just fun Halloween.
That's our job, people. But we're not mean.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah,
exactly.
That's our job, exactly. But we're not mean. Yes. So Tim Burton said that Oogie Boogie is not a true villain. He's just, he just is his job in this Halloween land. But he definitely is like, likes to torture people, which none of them wanted. He is a little mean, I guess, but.
Yeah, he's a cheater.
But again, it doesn't really make sense. He is a cheater. But Tim Burton was saying that while Oogie Boogie is sort of the quote unquote villain of this movie, there is his Tim Burton says there is no real villain, but I don't know. I don't think that makes sense, but that's what Tim Burton says.
Well, I think you have to define the villain or the antagonist by who is the protagonist. And to me, it was Santa Claus.
Oh yeah.
You know,
I was going to say Sally, like, maybe.
Well, and Sally a little bit.
Sally had no direct conflict with anybody except for, you know, Boogie.
Her captor for a sec.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, so.
No, Jack is, I mean, we would say.
He's, you know, sort of the protagonist.
But he went
after Santa Claus, and that's where my loyalties went.
Jack is like an anti-hero. But not really. But I don't know how else to explain it.
He's making bad choices.
Well, I mean, there's an overriding sense to this movie, though. You get it. Like, you're right. That isn't heroes and villains. It's just like a bunch of characters just are the way they are.
Yes.
Right.
Halloween creature's job to be Halloween. Christmas's job to be Christmas. This is just people just are the way they are. Like, no one is bad. No one is good. This is just like.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think that's.
Thing, which is why there's a message about accepting who you are.
Yeah. Like. And I don't think it was, you know, I think even Tim Burton's analyzing the movie after it was made, you know, and that comment he made about Boogie not being bad might have been like post-analysis. You know, I don't know if he always intended that because, yeah, as an audience member, Boogie seems like literally
he's definitely the scariest
story, though, remember, like you said.
Yeah, they had
There was no character
story
mapped out.
Because, like Grace said, the original poem, the only characters were Jack, Santa Claus, and Zero in the poem.
Yeah.
And then he had some conceptual artwork later. But another thing about Oogie Boogie, which is probably why we're sort of like, is he a villain? All that stuff, is apparently the original ending when they ripped the bag off was not bugs. It was going to be Dr. Finkelstein all along as Oogie Boogie. And they showed the storyboard to Tim Burton and he hated it. And he was like, absolutely not. You will not do this. And then they changed it to Bugs. Is that when he kicked a hole in the wall? Yeah, he showed up and like kicked a hole in a wall. He was so pissed. I don't know if it was that, but he got pissed about a lot of things. Apparently there were some interesting stories.
I thought that was the one.
I think you're right. But apparently he like left, and the next day someone wrote on the wall, Tim kicked a hole here. And then they cut that hole and that thing out, and someone framed it where he kicked a hole in the wall. The animators. It's kind of funny.
Because he would just show up to like approve stuff. Like that's all he really
did. He was barely there. He just
threw tantrums and was like, oh, that's great. Oh, that sucks. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Apparently, according to the documentaries we watched, he was barely really on set. Because again, he was all on doing Batman. And even though like one of the art directors for this movie was also the art director on Batman and was in Hollywood throughout the week and then would fly to San Francisco where they filmed all this every weekend. So that's why the animators and Danny Elfman were kind of like, okay, I guess we're just going to start making this movie and hopefully it works out. Like, but yeah, he was like, definitely not. And then they changed it to Bugs. And then they basically finished the movie. And then the screenwriter went, I can write a better ending than the Bugs. Like, let me change the ending again, because I feel like this could be better. And then Tim Burton was like, absolutely not. Don't change it. The movie's over. Wrap. Premiere. So who knows? The movie could have maybe had another ending after that, but
maybe should have, honestly. The end is so weak, except for that very end, very, very, very end moment with the romance. I like that. But like the way the story ends is just like, what happened?
No, I was kind of agreeing with you that the story just sort of stops, but it goes right back to the romance, and that's a lovely ending. But you know what? When that burlap skin got pulled off of him and it was all Bugs, I literally went, ew.
I mean, I know.
It was brilliant. It was a great choice.
That part like really creeped me out as a kid. And maybe because we've seen it so much, Jimmy, but I actually feel like the first time you watch it, you are a little bit entranced by that ending. Like, oh, he's just a bunch of bugs and he's gone. It's not
the fact that Oogie Boogie is a bunch of bugs that I don't like. I actually love that. But it's just the way the story ends.
Yeah, it's kind of like abrupt.
It's just like, wait, what? I don't even understand the plot, really. That he was going to kidnap Santa Claus so that he could be Santa Claus. But he needed all the people in Halloween Town to make the toys. Because he thought, I honestly don't understand.
He thought they were going to love the toys and he was going to bring joy to everybody.
No, he had to kidnap Santa Claus so that he would be the one bringing toys. And there wouldn't be him and Santa Claus out there at the same time bringing toys. And he even says when they do kidnap him, he goes, thank you, Santa. Take a vacation. I'm going to cover you this year. Like he's not trying to after Christmas is over, he was going to put Santa Claus back. Obviously, it's horrible that he had Santa Claus kidnapped, but I'm just taking your
King. Yeah.
But he does tell Shock, Lock, and Barrel, like, don't wrap up Oogie Boogie in this. And of course they take Santa Claus to him and
right.
You know, they weren't supposed to do that.
Well, like, he spends so much time trying to figure out what Christmas means. And then he's like, yeah, I'll just do it. I'll just be Santa Claus. Like, there's just some sort of leap in.
Yeah, because Jack. Go ahead.
There's Grace. A moment where the kids, Lock, Shock, and Barrels, like, they asked them why they took him to Oogie Boogie, and they say, Jack said to keep him comfortable, and this is the most comfortable place we know. So maybe Jack really didn't want them to hurt him at all.
Well, yeah, he did kind of say specifically, don't take him to Oogie Boogie. Yeah, I don't think he did. I think it was sort of innocent. He didn't mean for him to get tortured or potentially melted or whatever Oogie was going to do to him. But, you know, I just don't get why he decided he had to do all this in the first place.
Because when he went to Christmasland, it was so different than what he was doing all along. He was bored with Halloween land. He
didn't understand it. What does it mean? You know,
what does it mean? But he also, no,
I want to do.
Let me, because he felt a change. He felt a sense of joy. He even says something like that. Like, he felt a sense of happiness and joy being in Christmastown, which he's never felt before, only knowing Halloween land. And he wanted to continue feeling that. and bring it to others. But because he's the Pumpkin King, he still never really understood how to bring that joy, but he liked the way it felt.
Yeah. I mean, yep. That is what the movie says. It just doesn't flow logically for me, but, and you know, it doesn't need to, it's just a cartoon, but yeah. It's just like a weird feeling I have. Like by the end of the movie, I'm like, okay, this started really strong and I kind of don't know how we got where we got and how everything got resolved, even though I just saw it. It's just kind of, I get that feeling when I watch this movie a little bit. That's all.
All right. Well, I think it's time to start wrapping this up. We are going to do our favorite and least favorite things. We're going to bring that back since it is our special. So we're going to start with least favorite scene only. Least favorite scene. Jimmy, start us off.
It's either Making Christmas, just because I'm so tired of the musical style by that point, and it's such a grating number, and it kind of takes a long time. Or Kidnap the Santa Claus, because that takes a really long time, and I don't like the song. And I know a lot of people like it, including you, Kelly, but that song is very annoying to me, and I don't like that they're singing about doing all of this terrible, terrible stuff to Santa Claus. For some reason, it rubs me the wrong way.
We've been talking about this since we were children.
Yeah.
How bothersome, how scary that song is to Santa Claus.
Yeah, so that one, it's maybe a better song than Making Christmas, but I just really don't like that scene. And I honestly get the feeling of just like fast forwarding through it, even though I don't, because I want to watch the full thing. Like, end already. So I think I'll do Kidnap, but Making Christmas, second place.
Okay, Byron?
Yeah, it's the same one that Jimmy was talking about, the Kidnap Santa Claus one. I don't know why. I think it must be the music and just everyone's been talking about their ear getting fatigued. I think that's why. I actually prefer Making Christmas as a song than the other way around. So, yeah, that one, the Kidnap Santa Claus.
All right, Grace?
Definitely Kidnap the Santa Claus, but I mean, it does get annoying, like they said, but I think I just remember it viscerally being like disturbed by that song. Like it was scary to me, and they were going to hurt him. And he's like, once they have him and they're just like, ha ha, and he's like helpless. It's like, it's sad. I don't like it.
Okay, Cynthia.
I only saw it once, so I'll go with the majority here on that song. I didn't listen to the songs all that much. I just paid more attention to how the story was being told. So I feel more stronger about the song I like the most than the least. But I'll stick with this one that everybody else is saying.
Okay, Daniel?
My initial reaction is that, like, I don't necessarily have a least favorite scene. There's no scene that I immediately want to throw under the bus. But you know what? On this watch through the songs, I have to say that Making Christmas is the song that did the least for me. I think that like, I don't dislike Kidnap the Santa Claus because I am a sick person and I have a fan for sneaking terrible things into kids' movies. I love it. The song about burying him alive and beating him with a stick in a kid's movie. It's crazy. Yeah. I love it. It's great.
It's so funny how Grace said you guys crazy. As kids talked about how you don't like this song, and Daniel and I fucking loved this song as kids. Like, I remember Daniel knew all the words and I didn't. And this was before you could just Google the lyrics on the internet. And Daniel, I don't know if you remember this. I had you write out the lyrics to Kidnap the Santa Claus for me so I could learn them.
I'm pretty sure they were just like in the CD booklet, but...
I didn't know that at the time because I was little, but you hand wrote them out for me and I memorized the lyrics from the sheet you wrote me because I was obsessed again because I love all the little wordy stuff in there. Like, oh God, what is it? Like,
we'll catch this I'm
mixing up words. That one!
And boil then put him in a lollipop
and butter him up!
Crazy! Yeah,
that's these the are line. Like little kids. I love that like line.
Kids? You're supposed to be kids. It's insane. It's insanity.
You're so stupid. Think now if we blow him up to smithereens, we may lose some pieces and then Jack will beat us black and green. I don't know.
They have limits. They have a line. The line is we can't blow him up. There is a line that they don't cross.
Anyways, that's definitely not my least favorite part of the movie. I mean, I am a little tired of making Christmas, but actually my least favorite part, and I know we're kind of all just going with song here, I don't really like Something's Up with Jack or Jack's Obsession. I think that one's kind of boring. Something's up with Jack. That one, I could skip that one, then I'd be fine.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick.
All right, favorite scene, Jimmy.
What's this?
Yeah, What's This is great. Yep. Great song. Okay, Byron?
My favorite scene is anything involving that mountaintop. So the two times they go over the mountain, I'm going to put into one scene because that's just so stunning and so cool. So iconic as well.
Okay, Grace, favorite scene?
I like when Jack is there to confront Oogie Boogie, and then they're doing that sequence with the cards and the swords and shit.
Yeah.
You know? And he's like dodging them and stuff. I like that part.
So that's a great action scene.
Yeah.
I have to think it's What Is This? When he's discovering Christmas for the first time. That's my favorite scene.
Daniel, favorite scene?
It's like the same thing as my favorite song. But we know
what Kidnap it is. Santa Claus?
Get rid of No, not Kidnap Santa Claus. This is not my favorite song.
Okay, you're it's waiting until favorite song. Okay, we can wait until we get there.
If you unless you want a segue, because that is the next thing, right?
But well, no, I need to say what my favorite scene is.
Okay, go ahead and say what your favorite scene is if you have a
I don't even know what my favorite scene is, actually.
Okay.
I love everything. Oh god. What is my favorite scene? I mean, yeah, it's hard to not wrap it up with favorite song. If I were to try to think of something that's not related. Okay. My favorite song is something different, but I guess on this watch, like Jimmy and I kind of already said, just the very ending scene with him and Sally on the hilltop, it's covered in snow. They're talking about how they love each other. Zero's flying around. They kiss with the big moon and Zero flies off at the end. I'll just go with the ending. It's my favorite scene, separate from favorite song. Okay. Now favorite song. Jimmy?
My favorite song is just that melody in general that we hear at that end scene that you just described. And when Sally sings it, it's like it's such a break for your ears from that fatigue we've all been talking about. And it's just like got that those beautiful Danny Elfman chords where it just sounds so ethereal and magical. And it's melodic, but it still has a sort of uniqueness, sort of an off-kilterness, sort of like Sally does. And anyway, I loved it, this rewatch. I was like, and it got stuck in my head. And then when it comes back at the end, again, reprised, I'm like, wow, I really love that. So that's my choice.
All right, Byron.
Favorite song is the jazz band Christmas sort of rendition that they do sort of right before Jack takes off. I don't know, just cool. Like Jimmy said, Danny Elfman chord structures and all that. But I like that band a lot. So I'm going with them.
Like with the Sad Jingle Bells?
Yeah, Sad Jingle Bells. And then they get better towards the end.
What song is it
that they do?
I don't remember.
Because it's not Jingle Bells, I don't think.
Like what child is this?
One is though. They play it like a dirge.
Well, when he first is like, "Can you figure out Jingle Bells?" That's the first song. But I think that's when he's about to fly off, like Byron's saying, I don't think they're playing Jingle Bells. I think they're playing something else, but I can't remember what it is.
Me neither.
But you know what's funny? Every time I hear them do Jingle Bells in that one scene, I just think of teaching beginning band how to play Jingle Balls, because that's what it sounds like.
I had the same thought this time. I'm like, that's very beginning
that
band.
That is what beginning band children learning their instruments sound like when they try to play Jingle Balls, exactly like
it
that.
Is exactly.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Okay. Grace, favorite song?
Definitely Sally's song and the reprise, mostly the reprise. But I agree with Jimmy. It's just such a gift after all that like dissonant tonal shit that sounds so similar to me. I was telling my mom earlier, like, this is the only song I can really recognize aside from What's This. That one is the only thing I really see as its own standalone that I could tell you it starts here and it ends there.
Yeah. Those are also two of the shortest songs in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. All right, Cynthia, favorite song?
Well, it's also my favorite scene, and it's called What's This? And it's like discovering Christmas for the first time, you know, all over again. And I wonder if the lyrics are as good as the performance, you know, because the singing was breathy and full of discovery.
You're right.
And it's not easy to do that in a song. But it was, and it was fresh and believable. And of course, you know, then all the things we love about Christmas that he'd never seen before, whether it was the little choo-choo trains or, you know, gift wrap on presents and, you know, the little snowballs. I mean, everything. So that's my favorite song. I mean, I don't know, Kelly, do you think that's in people's Christmas playlists?
Why not? I think it's a Christmas song.
Yeah.
It's all about Christmas. It's literally just describing Christmas the whole time.
Over. It's never made it to the big time of Christmas songs around piano. But
I mean, I think if you just went on Spotify and Google and searched like Christmas playlist, I think it probably is on some of them.
Maybe it is, yeah. And a close second, though, is that Oogie Boogie song.
Yeah.
I think it's called the Oogie Boogie song, but it's just funny and just performed so well. So there you go.
Yeah.
It's the performance is great. Yeah, I will say about what
kills it on What's This.
Yeah. Sorry. The What's This though too, I like you said, he's like breathy and full of discovery. And it's so like, what's the word? Energetic and full of life, his singing. And I love how at the very end, he's just like, I've got to know what is this place that I have found? What is this? And he finally gets a little angry at the very end. I love it. It's so good.
Heavy and Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah. Okay, Daniel, favorite song?
My favorite song and also my favorite scene is This Is Halloween, which I think is like, I would put on my list of like great all-time movie openings.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Almost like the movie, I think, is very front-loaded. I mean, you could just like the great first 20 minutes. It's just like so great. It's just exactly. It's an earwormy song, and it's just like all of the Halloween monsters come out, and it's just so great. And the animation is like, you could just like stop it. I mean, that alone is just the great. I mean, the way that the stop motion, and then they had to like animate the fire and the ghosts on top of it with like, it's just so good. Like, I'm just going to watch it as soon as we're done with this again.
You're making me want to watch it again.
I will. Like, I will. That's just,
you know, on this rewatch, like,
you know,
something about that song I noticed, like a lyric I never really noticed before that I really like, is when it's like, I am the one when you say who's there. I am the wind blowing through your hair. Like, I never noticed that first part. Like, I'm the one when you say who's there. And like, how kind of creepy that is when you think about it, when you like think you hear something. I don't know. I just like that line. Favorite song for me is Jack's Lament, the second song in the movie, when he walks in the forest.
There are few who deny it. What I do, I am the best. For my talents are renowned far and wide.
I will sing that song with all my heart. Like, it's so good. And it's so well performed. Oh my God, I love it.
It's very operatic. Like,
I know, and I love that about it. I love it.
Like, expository.
Well, and even goes, like, and monologue, since I am dead, I can take off my head to recite Shakespearean quotations.
Oh, you just, you're like, Danny Elf is just having so much fun at that moment.
It's so good. I love it.
That's
all I can say.
The Shakespearean quotations moment. Is always
probably one of the best lines. Yes. Great. Yeah. Great.
I think that's probably when I first heard of Shakespeare, was that line. I didn't know what that even meant. But yeah.
Okay. Favorite character, Jimmy. And there's a lot of great characters in this movie. So
I You know, I feel like I've been picking the protagonist a lot recently, or like the obvious like main character, which I guess is a good thing for the movies. But yeah, anyway, it's Jack again. Sorry, but it's Jack. He's my favorite character. Like I could pick some oddball character who I think is also good, but I love when Jack's on screen, and I love the guy. Even when he's got his creepy laugh going and just like his soliloquies and everything. Cool. And dude, when he's like walking around all creepy, almost like a daddy long leg spider.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so cool. I love his design. I love Jack.
All right, Byron.
Boogie Boogie. I like the animation for him. His little, I think they like somehow they figured out how to animate a hollow burlap sack, which sounds really hard to me.
He was apparently one of the hardest puppets to make.
I'm not surprised. But I love his songs. Oogie Boogie.
All right, Grace.
I like Dr. Finkelstein just because the character's so funny. And I think that the way that they animated him and like his like duck mouth is a really good testament to like a character's like visual speaking to the character, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
The visual of this fucking duck mouth little speaks to who he is, you know?
That one part when he's like, Sally, gone again, and they just like animate his lips like wiggle a little bit.
Yeah. So funny.
Yeah. Cynthia, favorite character?
I would say that it's Jack. Very, very well created character. Also, I don't know who said this, but I love the look of him. It's so consistent. Anyway, he carries the story. He sings most of the songs. You know, he changes. He's a character that matters in the story. Many of them were very well created visually. I like that little fat kid in the striped shirt. I don't know his name, but I liked him.
Beryl?
What?
Beryl, the trick-or-treater? One of the ones that kidnapped Sammy?
No, the fat one that goes like, there goes Christmas.
Oh, the little zombie boy. The little zombie. He's just called Zombie Boy, I think.
Yeah, Zombie Boy. But I think Jack was just so, such a great character, you know? Yeah. And I can understand why he's so iconic and a favorite, you know, and all of you guys. It's like part of your life. You know, because this movie is so important to you.
Daniel, favorite character?
Favorite character. First of all, shout out to Zero.
Yes.
One of the movie dogs, a movie dog for the times. Got to give a shout out to Zero.
Yeah.
Man, you know what? I have to say, this is a thought I had watching this movie. I don't normally go for protagonists. I think that's like too obvious and boring. But like, I like go for Jack. And I don't even know what it is. He doesn't do anything like especially, you know, he's just, you know, he is like the character who just carries the story. He has his flaws and he learned, but it's just like at the end when it's like, I remember like even seeing the movie as a kid when like he shows up at the end to get Oogie Boogie. And, you know, it's like usually, well, it's obvious that the protagonist gets the villain, but when Jack shows up and he like flips over the thing and he's there and it's just like, oh yeah, Oogie Boogie, Jack's going to get you now. Cause Jack is just like so awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't even know why you think Jack is just so awesome, but he just is. Like there are
you
few
see him
movie
get
protagonists
into his spider mode and he's all crawling around and using his long legs to get from like obstacle to obstacle. Yeah.
Yeah.
He gets Jack to show off why he is like the king in that moment.
Yeah.
Exactly. Who doesn't like the Pumpkin King, who is the king of Halloween scare? Who doesn't want to, you know?
You know, isn't it funny that he's the Pumpkin King, but he's a skeleton? Why isn't he the Skeleton King?
Because that
when we first see him, no, I've always kind of wondered that. When you first see him arrive on the scene in Halloween Land,
I know he has a pumpkin on.
He's a scarecrow with a pumpkin head.
It doesn't really make sense, but whatever.
Yeah, and then he does like cartwheels and dance to go. He's like on when he's on fire.
Yeah,
and right. Like he gets put out of the fountain. That's just great.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a younger kid, my favorite character was Oogie Boogie, I think, because I thought he was like really cool and like scary and I loved his song. But he's honestly, he's like barely in this movie. And I'm just going to say the same boring answer. It's got to be Jack Skellington now because he has my favorite songs. The real answer is my favorite character is Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
Good answer.
But shout out to Santa Claus because he he keeps it real. He keeps him in line as best he can and he fixes it really at the end. So shout out to Santa Claus. All right. Final thoughts and letter grades. Jimbo, you're up.
I mean, I've gotten a chance to say a lot of what I think about the movie already. But yeah, this is a movie that I kind of came to appreciate more over time. I always liked the look of it because it looked so different, the claymation and stuff. But I didn't really like the music as a young kid at first because it is so kind of hard to listen to at times and sort of operatic, which I wasn't really into as a youngster. And it wasn't until the resurgence, right? Like we talked about in the 2000s that I sort of got a deeper appreciation for it. Having had more musical training and stuff and appreciating the music on a deeper level. And then of course, throughout my life, you know, going to film school for a year and a half and things like just appreciating it for other reasons. So anyway, I've just come to appreciate it more and more. But it wasn't one of those movies I always loved. I think watching it is enjoyable because it like marks the year and marks the Halloween season. And I will probably always watch it like every year of my life. But there are times when I'm watching it when I'm like, I either fall asleep or I just kind of want to fast forward, even though I don't. I just get this feeling like, ugh, like show me one of the parts that I like. Which isn't a good thing for a movie. Maybe it's just that I've seen it too many times. You know, that could be too. But although the creative genius on display deserves an A plus, because of those things I said, I think I give it an A minus.
Okay. Fair. Byron.
There's always been people that have loved this movie more than me. It's definitely a singular film. I can't think of any movie quite like it, other than like Corpse Bride, maybe. But I think the technical achievements alone really put it in a class of its own. Don't really care about the story. I don't really think that's important. I think the idea was to have, you know, a spooky Christmas movie, and that's exactly what it is. I don't watch this movie every year. I probably won't watch it again next year. I'll always be fond of it. I'll always respect it. But it's not one that is in my top five of anything, other than maybe animation. I'm just going to give it a B. I respect the hell out of it, but it's not a top fiver for me.
Okay. Cynthia.
Hey, well, I know you guys love it. I'm super glad I saw it, almost because it just helps me understand, you know, my kids better, all of you. And I was always kind of embarrassed that I'd never seen it before. I am very, very, very impressed with the technical achievement of the film. But as a movie, as a whole, you know, I'm going to give this a C+. It was a good movie. It wasn't great. It wasn't bad. It was a C+ to me. I don't have the affinity you guys do because of all the many years and songs and your friends all sharing it and probably wearing the costumes and the t-shirts before. So standing on its own, I think it's a good film. I'm more impressed. Like I was saying earlier, I want to know how they made it more than I want to watch the movie again. I'd much rather see a documentary about the filming of this film of Nightmare Before Christmas than necessarily watching it again.
Okay. Grace.
I feel similar to her. I have always liked this movie. But there were always people that liked it more than me. They may have been very close to me, but I never fully bought into the whole to it. It was always like, okay. But I do recognize its achievements, as you guys have said, and its staying power, that it's still popular with young people, that they still resonate with it. Kids that are finding it today, that's worth mentioning. So I think I'm going to give it a really high C, like a solid pass. I don't need to see it again. Even when I watched it last night, I was looking at my phone a lot. Like, I got up and took the dog out and was like, oh shit, I need to go back and pause that. Like, I just kind of forgot that it was on. So it's been great, but I think I'm over it.
Okay. Daniel.
Okay. I have to be honest about, I think the reason that I love this movie and what it means. Cause I think it's like, how would I describe it? It's like the mischievous little stinker in the middle of like the Disney Renaissance era, because I have a complicated relationship with the Renaissance era Disney films. And like, I know that a lot of people love those, but I really like the overwhelmingness of what they mean to our generation is kind of annoying to me. And I love that this is like this little stink bomb in the middle of that era. And I love Danny Elfman's music for this more than any other score from any of those kids' movies. And just like, I love Halloween growing up and stuff. And I think that's where my love for this movie comes from. And I think it's just like a beautiful painting, basically. You know, it's just like, you watch it to just like the animation and the music and like the idea of what it is. It's almost like an hour long music video, basically, which is great. I love music videos. Let's see. I mean, I know that like there are limits to what it can be compared to other movies. I think it's a solid A for me. Some of that is probably sentimental and not so. Well, actually, no, like a lot of it is sentimental.
Yeah, a lot of it is for me too. but it's the accumulation of it's just so, appreciating things over the years.
It's so formative and bedrock for me because we like connects grew up you with to it your so past. Much.
Yeah.
It's like the whole Hot Topic ubiquity of it when I was in high school should be annoying, but it isn't that annoying. I think a solid A sounds like the right grade for me. It's maybe not.
The Hot Topic A, part is a little annoying. But
yeah,
I was definitely not one of those kids ever, I would say. But, you know, I started finally making a list on my phone of like my favorite movies of all time. And favorite doesn't necessarily mean best. But to me, a favorite movie is a movie that if it's on, I'll watch it. You know, a great example that I'll come up with because it happened recently is Jaws. I fucking love Jaws. If Jaws is on the TV, I'm going to sit down and watch it. If Back to the Future is on the TV, I'm going to sit down and watch it. If West Side Story is on the TV, I'm going to sit down and watch it. If The Nightmare Before Christmas is on the TV, I'm going to sit down and watch it. Now, similar to what Grace was saying, though, we watched this twice this week before we recorded this. And the first time I was like going to the bathroom on my phone a little bit. But I was like singing the songs and saying all the dialogue more than I was maybe really watching it. And then, you know, earlier today I was taking a shower and I put the soundtrack on and I was more focused on the lyrics because the visuals weren't in front of me, sort of like we were talking about earlier. And I probably like the music more than I like the movie. Probably not. I like the music more than I like the movie. Like if I had a choice, I would probably just put on the soundtrack more than I would like sit and watch the whole movie. Doesn't mean I don't like the movie, but such a big part of why I love this movie is the music and the songs. And after this discussion, and like I said, finally sitting down and really watching it critically after watching it my whole life with like, you know, rose-colored glasses, you know, I think on the, you know, the achievements alone and the music, it's fun to watch visually. Who doesn't love Halloween and Christmas and getting it all weird together? So I think I'm with Jimmy. I think I'm going to give it an A-. Like, it's not a perfect movie, but if it's on, I'm going to fucking watch it and I'm going to sing my heart out to every single song.
That's true. So I can confirm that.
Yes. Poor Jimmy's listening to me sing the songs for like 5 days straight now. And I get real into it. Especially those Jack songs. Anyways, we were watching it and like every little, my favorite line I would sing and then I would turn to Jimmy and go, I love that line. I probably did that like 20 times. I'm sorry. anyways, there you have it, Night Before Christmas. A little mix there. I think that's probably one of our most mixed grades we've ever given a movie so far.
Huh. We should try to have more of those in the future. That makes
Makes
for better podcasting.
I think so. I agree. Well, next up, we're going to return back to our Pixar rewatch. And next on the list is Toy Story 4. Number 4, you guys. Coming up.
That was Toy Story 3.
You probably haven't seen Toy Story 4, Cynthia.
I think I have, but can you just give me the slightest...
Sporky.
It's the one that has Sporky.
The antique store.
Yeah, there's an antique store with a doll and like a ventriloquist dummy.
I've seen it, yeah.
Oh, you have seen it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Toy Story 4 is up next. After that, there's only a few left. Christmas is coming back up, so stick around. We'll probably do another Christmas special in there before we finish up with Pixar. But yes, your homework, or our homework and our listeners' homework, is to watch Toy Story 4. I hope you enjoyed our second Halloween special. Thanks for listening, and we will see you all next time.
Friday Flicks Podcast is a JK Entertainment production. All thoughts and opinions by the participants are theirs and theirs alone. Original theme music by Jimmy Anthony. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Friday Flicks Podcast for updates about future episodes. And please email us at jkentertainment247@gmail.com to contact us and let us know what you think. I'm your host, Kelly Anthony. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.